I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 8 years ago, when Barack Obama was being sworn in as president of the United States, he was facing an economy in freefall, losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month, with the housing and financial sector in crisis. Today, he leaves the country and the economy in better shape, although income inequality remains a serious problem and the debt has grown. President-elect Donald Trump called the Obama economy a disaster and promised to grow good jobs, renegotiate trade deals, punish businesses that move overseas, get rid of onerous regulations, and cut taxes. Today, we look back on the Obama years, what Trump has inherited, and how his policies might affect the economy and your pocketbook. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. And Mark Zandi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. Also with us and joining us by telephone is Philip Swagel. He's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy and former assistant secretary for economic policy at the Treasury Department under the Bush administration from 2006 to 2009. And Philip Swagel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me start with you, Mark Zandi. At Philip, I want to get you in on the conversation as well. How much credit, how much blame does President Barack Obama get for where we stand today?
Well, I'd give him credit. I think just think back to January of 2009. That was the month he was inaugurated. Hard to believe that in that month, 1 month, we lost 791,000 jobs. I just looked that up yesterday. So 791,000 jobs. That's just
chills.
Unbelievable. And in the Great Recession, and he came into office in the middle of the Great Recession, we lost 8.6 million jobs. The unemployment rate peaked at 10% in October of 2009. And now think fast forward 8 years later to today, December, last data point we got the last month of his office, we created 153,000 jobs. In fact, the economy's been creating jobs consistently now for almost 7 years. This is the longest stretch of consecutive job growth in the nation's economic history. The unemployment rate is now 4.7%. We can talk about lots of things, but for me, that is very telling. I don't think we could have done better than that.
And you say Obama did that with help, what, from the Federal Reserve, from other forces?
Sure. It's not all Obama. I do think he deserves a lot of credit for it. The first thing he did when he came into office, now this is February 2009, was pass the Recovery Act, the fiscal stimulus package. And in my mind, that was instrumental in ending the recession. So he was inaugurated in January. The Recovery Act was passed in February. And remember, we were losing hundreds of thousands, millions of jobs. The recession ended in June of 2009, and job growth began in earnest in February of 2010, and we have not looked back. So, yes, the Federal Reserve deserves a lot of credit, and a lot of other things mattered. But in my mind, President Obama and the Recovery Act were instrumental in turning the economy around.
To you, Philip Swagel, then what kind of an economy do you think Donald Trump has inherited?
He's inherited an economy that is doing much better than it has over the past couple of years, but still has some significant problems. As Mark said, we've come a long way from where we were when President Obama took over, which also is when I left the administration, the Bush administration. On the other hand, as you mentioned, the debt is not just up, but there's really no plan to address it. In some sense, President Obama came into office saying, he's not going to leave a fiscal mess behind, and he left a much worse one behind for his successor.
Philip Swagel, I need to jump in here only because we do not have a good phone line, and I can see looking at Mark's face that he's got a quizzical look because we can't hear every other word. So why don't you hang up? We will call you back and get you back in on the conversation. Fingers crossed it will get you on a better phone line. He did, though, Mark, mention the word debt, and the debt has gone up under President Obama.
Should
we be worried about that?
Yes, we should. Just to give you some more numbers. So the nation's debt to GDP ratio, which is a good proxy or good measure of our indebtedness as a nation, was 40% before the recession. It's now 75%. So that's a substantive increase, and that's the highest debt load since World War II. So this is this an issue, particularly if we add to it, and we'll come back to that, I'm sure, in the context right. of talking about Mr. Trump and his policies. But I would say that much of that increase, and we can debate how much, but much of that increase was due to the recession itself. So when the economy is evaporating, GDP is falling, unemployment is rising, tax revenues are going to decline and government spending is going to increase because people are on unemployment insurance, they need food stamps and other support. So I think a large part of the increase in the debt load is just a simple function of the fact that we weren't through this, massive recession.
But you're saying 75, that ratio, 75%, that's not a good number.
No, it's manageable. I don't think it's existential. Interest rates are very low, markets are calm, there's no sense that that's a problem. But, if you look at the future and what current policy is going to look like going forward under reasonable assumptions, that's going to rise. Even if we don't add to it, even if we don't have additional tax cuts or increases in government spending that are deficit finance, that's going to increase. And so we need to address this. A lot of it, of course, revolves around health care and the cost of health care, which we can talk about.
We will.
But that is, key to addressing that particular problem.
Philip Swiga, let me get you in on the conversation. And Mark Zandi talked about the fact that the debt has gone up, really underscoring what you said. How should that be addressed?
Okay, good. I hope this line is better.
Much better. Thank you very much.
Oh,
I'm
very
sorry
good.
About that.
Okay,
no,
great.
We want to hear
you.
Go ahead.
No, good. And thanks to your technical staff are excellent. This is 2 points. And Mark and I are going to agree on a lot of things, a lot of the diagnoses, and we might differ on the prescriptions in some sense, to make a physician analogy.
Sure.
Right. So the debt is up. And as Mark said, some of that is cyclical effects, right? The recession and things like that. What is worrying to me is that there's no plan to address it. And it's not just no plan, but President Obama's taking us away from addressing it, right? He's taken us pretty far politically from being able to address it. And it's exactly the opposite of where he came into office. And, he had a chance to do it, right, with the, his own commission that he rejected the advice of. And then since then, he's, walked away and campaigned against, fiscal responsibility. And so that's the difficult situation he's leaving to a successor. The other difficulty he's leaving to the next president in a week is slow growth. Right. And I don't mean catastrophically slow growth. Right. We're not going to start speaking French or Italian here. But, right. It's very pretty. Actually, I gather our first lady does, which are the incoming.
Yeah,
first lady
there you
does,
go.
Which
okay.
is fascinating.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
We have an economy that is underperforming in a systematic way. Right. We're looking at 2% growth and. Low 2%. I don't think we're going to get to 4% or 5% on a sustained basis, but we should be able to get to 3% on a sustained basis. And the piece that's missing is business investment, right? That's the piece that's been missing from the economy. And I think we have to connect that to President Obama in some regards.
Does technology, does that have anything to do with productivity? The fact that we're more reliant on it to make stuff, Philip?
It does, and it says technology should have mostly good effects, but also some negative effects. And there's a short term versus long term, right? And the short term technology can displace people, especially displace workers, and we see that most acutely in the manufacturing sector. Over time, though, productivity should make workers more productive, right? You give someone a front load, so a piece of machinery, and they're much more productive with that piece of machinery, and therefore they can do more, their wages are higher, and so on. So, that's the challenge, is assimilating new technology and then make sure that the benefits of it pass through to workers. And I know we'll get to inequality, and this is by far not President Obama's fault, right, that we've had a more equal, unequal society, but it's one of the challenges we face, and I feel like we haven't done as much as we could to address it.
Yeah, and I want to get to all of that. Let me just, though, quote something that I read actually last month in the New York Times, Eduardo Porter, talking about manufacturing. And he said, yes, the economy has added millions of jobs since President Obama took office. Even manufacturing employment has recovered some of its losses. Still, less educated white voters had a solid economic rationale for voting against the status quo. Nearly all the gains from the economic recovery has passed them by. I want to put this to both of you, but to you, Mark, and people talk about a man session that seems to that men seem to have been harder hit by this recession. And perhaps it's a very specific segment of the potential workforce, less educated white male voters.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. You know, I think because we dug ourselves such a deep hole in the recession, 10% unemployment rate at the peak, it took the entire Obama term, two terms, 8 years to get out of the hole. And in fact, it's just now, literally, I mean, I think right now that the economy is now back pretty close to full employment, the 4.7% unemployment rate, even if you consider the underemployed. We're just now getting. So what that means is that you know, that's kind of an average statistic, kind of in the middle of the distribution. So that means half the population, they've been out of the hole for a while. They're feeling pretty good. They probably voted for Clinton. But that also means half the population is still in the hole. They're not out yet. They're just now getting out. And they probably voted for Trump. And, you know, for those folks, when you've been in the hole for so long, you think you're never going to get out, right? Thus you vote for change. It doesn't really matter what the change is, even if you don't understand what the change is. Doesn't matter. I just want something different.
You don't like what
you're
dealing
with. Yeah, you don't like the status quo. And you want something. Give me something else because this isn't working for me. So I get that. I understand that.
Well, Philip, about a minute before our first break here, but there is this question about labor force participation, and it's at 62.7% as I read in preparation for the show, and that is low. Does that tell us something about just why so many people feel so disaffected with the U.S. economy?
It does, in part. I mean, in part, it's the people who aren't working, and then part is people who are working but making very low wages. You know, making very little. And we have a challenge on both fronts, right? So one thing to address would be the people who aren't working, and whether that's single parents who are staying home with their kids, or maybe the man session that Mark talked about, and it's just, you know, millions of men who maybe would have been building homes before the bubble burst and haven't really connected. And it might be tough for them to go back and become an MRI technician or, you know, something, you know, like that in a sector that's expanding. And both of those are part of our challenge to get a stronger economy.
Well, let's take that short break. We've been spending a lot of the first portion of the show talking about the Obama economy, as we call it. And I do want to talk about some of the ideas that Trump has President-elect Donald Trump has put out there. Philip Swagel, professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you want President-elect Donald Trump to do? Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Mark Zandi and Philip Swagel. We've been talking about the Obama economy, what President-elect Donald Trump will inherit. Also, his plans for the economy, and that includes his talk about trade deals, reviving the steel and coal industries, investing in infrastructure, reducing taxes, deporting undocumented immigrants, growing the economy by more than 4%, things he said from the campaign trail. Let me turn to you, Philip Swagel, and it seems as if the stock market, certainly since the election in November of Donald Trump, has been going gangbusters. Why do you think the stock market is so happy about the results of this election?
It sure has been a remarkable response, and it's just as people were so focused on secular stagnation, the idea that we're stuck with slow growth forever for a long time, Mr. Trump shows that maybe it's the opposite. I think markets are looking ahead to tax reform as the most important driver of growth, and we can talk about the tax reform plan being put forward in the House. It's probably the other thing is just a change in the regulatory environment, mm-hmm. and this doesn't mean, you know, let's have a hydraulic fracturing in everyone's backyard. It doesn't mean sort of going wild on Wall Street, but it could be that the pendulum has swung too far on regulation, and just moving it back will change the growth environment as well.
What do you think, Mark Zandi? I mean, is it the thought that there would be no Dodd-Frank, for instance?
I think that's part of it. I don't think it's about growth. I think it's if you say to a stock investor, the company you've invested in will pay a lower tax rate, so I'm not going to pay as much in taxes. Right. That's a boon to the company. That's a boon to earnings. That's a boon to the stock investor. And I do think investors are discounting, meaning they expect with a high probability that we're going to get corporate tax reform that lowers the tax rate for businesses.
And that's certainly not a campaign on that.
Yeah, it's not a commentary on – we can talk about the good or bad of that. You know, there's a lot of good in that, but I don't think it's about growth. I think it's just simple arithmetic. I'm going to get – this company's going to have more in after-tax earnings. The other is deregulation. Dodd-Frank, you mentioned, that's regulation of the financial system. So the stock market has – stock prices have increased more for financial stocks, meaning Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, you know, these big, too big to fail large institutions that were being heavily regulated and asked to raise a lot of capital under Dodd-Frank. The investors are thinking that regulation is going to be less burdensome. The cost of doing business will go down. Therefore, I'm going to buy the stock of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Bank of America. So I don't think it's about growth. I think it's about, you know, I'm going to give you a lower tax rate and I'm going to lower your cost of doing business because I'm going to regulate you less.
Is it about greed? If it's not about growth, is it about greed? People are going to be making more money.
But it's not greed. It's just that's the way it works. I mean, you know, if I'm a stock investor, that means I have a share in your company. If your company is going to generate more profits after tax, that means the value of my stock is higher. That's not greed. That's just the way it works. Yeah.
Let me go back to you, Philip Swagel. You had mentioned income inequality. And does this booming stock market in certain ways reflect the income inequality that people making money off of stocks are doing, or stocks and bonds are doing better than those who are making money off of wages?
You know, it does, and I want to say a word back on deregulation also, and your what you said about Dodd-Frank. But let me answer
sure.
directly first. It does, and I would link it back to some of the political unhappiness that we saw that boosted Mr. Trump's election. We've had a recovery, but the gains by far have gone to the people in the top of the income distribution. And you see that both in earnings, right, in wages, and also in capital income, right, the value of assets. The Fed is probably part of that, right? And the Fed has taken extraordinary steps, very useful steps, to boost the economy and sustain the recovery. But the benefits from that have probably flowed overwhelmingly to people at the top.
I read the richest 1% owns half of the country's wealth. Is that right, Philip?
I don't have that number off the top of my head. Mark might well have it.
That sounds a little high, but it's in the spirit of you make the point. It's a good point. Income is highly concentrated, but wealth is much more highly concentrated.
Is that bad for an economy, not just this one? Is that a bad ratio to have?
I think it is. Generally, the distribution of income and wealth doesn't have impacts on growth, particularly in big countries like the United States. But the income and wealth distribution has become so skewed over the past 30, 35 years, beginning back in the late 70s and early 80s, that I do think it's having broader economic implications. And, it's a tricky question, actually. If you look at the literature on this, no one's really connected the dots from income, wealth distribution, and economic growth. But my intuition is that it does matter when we have such wide disparities. I will say one thing, though, about the Obama performance. The distribution of income, wealth has not gotten better under his stewardship, but it has not gotten worse. The skewing has actually stabilized over the last 10 years. If you look at the statistics on both, they have stabilized. They're still not where you'd want them. You want them, I think you'd want a more equitable distribution, but but at least they're not eroding.
Philip Swiger, let me turn to you. And as I said, when Donald Trump was campaigning for president, he talked a lot about things like trade deals and bringing back the coal industry. Let's start with trade deals. Do we need to, for instance, get out of TPP and renegotiate some of these trade deals? Have they hurt the country? Have they hurt individuals in this country?
Well, the trade deals have certainly hurt individuals, and we see that in particular industries. You know, we don't need to get out of TPP because we weren't in it, right?
Yes, correct.
Hillary Clinton said she wasn't going to do it either. Right. So in some sense, it's a bit of a moot point. You know, it would be useful if the Trump administration negotiates new trade deals. And I would start with Japan. Right? Japan was a big part of TPP. They're very eager for it. It's a way for us to support our ally. And it would be good for our country. Right? Trade is fundamentally good for the United States. It absolutely hurts many people. And we've got to find a way to spread the benefits and make sure that the growing economy helps everyone.
How do you do that?
The challenge of trade. So I would say the best way to do it is to have a strong economy. And we've seen in the past, say the second half of the 1990s, we had rising trade. This is when President Clinton, in his second term, right, we had rising trade, right, a more globalized economy. We had technology affecting many people, yet the economy was strong, and it was so strong that wages at the bottom were rising. And there's a sense in which if the economy is strong and the benefits broadly shared, then socially we're okay with inequality, right? Inequality got vastly worse during President Clinton's second term, but that's not the goal, right? The goal is to have rising incomes mm-hmm. for everyone mm-hmm. And not necessarily inequality per se. Can I just go back really quickly to
sure.
something said before, and,
sure.
and you'll see the connection. And it's about deregulation, right? So the challenge is, as I said, to have stronger growth. And there's no one magic wand, right? I think tax reform along the lines of what the House of Representatives is putting forward would be a huge positive for growth. And there's lots of other things that could be in there, immigration, reform, trade deals, things like that. Deregulation is probably part of it. And right, a few minutes ago I said, oh, we've probably swung too far on regulation and mentioned a couple specific areas. And in some sense, I'm not trying to criticize you, but the next thing you said to Mark was, well, does this mean we're going to get rid of Dodd-Frank?
Right.
And,
I did say that,
you know, so
yes.
That's the political challenge is how do we say, you know, it's not like Dodd-Frank came down on stone tablets from Mount Sinai, right? I mean, there's things in it that are very good, and there's some things in it that you know, impose costs and slow our growth without concomitant benefits in terms of stability. And how do we improve it? And that's the challenge, right? For all the people who complained about Republicans saying no to anything President Obama proposed, now we're going to have 4 years of the opposite, and which I understand, but that's a challenge for us as a society, is how do we make incremental progress, you know, if big progress isn't possible.
No, and I think that's a fair point. And my understanding is Dodd-Frank is still being written, and it's thousands and thousands of pages, which, Mark, probably tells you something about just how complex regulation is and how it may not have the benefit that people want it to have.
Yeah, and I think Phil is right. It didn't come down from Mount Sinai, and it's not perfect, and there's a lot of things that could be improved, and I totally agree. But the fundamental principle of Dodd-Frank was the financial system screwed up big time. And I say that as a card-carrying member of the financial system. I'm part of the Moody's Corporation, which is, you know, deep into the bowels of the financial system.
Right.
We screwed up. So you have to do something about that. And that was Dodd-Frank. And there's mostly good in Dodd-Frank. It says, okay, we need more capital in the system to make it safer. We need our banks to be more liquid. We have to have a process in place to ensure that if big financial institutions start to fail, that we can resolve them. We have to have good risk management in place. This is Dodd-Frank. And if we aren't careful and we undermine that in this process of deregulation, then we're going backwards.
But do you need thousands and thousands of pages to do that?
Yes, you do.
You do?
Because it's very complex, because we're talking about, you know, I'll just give you examples. We trade derivatives. Trillions of notional values of derivatives. Prior to Dodd-Frank, they were done through bilateral trade agreements between major financial institutions. There was no controls. We didn't know who the counterparties were. So when Lehman Brothers was blowing up, they couldn't figure out, you know, who Lehman Brothers had had relationships with. So now it goes through an exchange. But that what I just described to you
yes.
is an incredibly complex thing, and it requires very, very careful analysis and legal statutory language. And so, yes, I say you do need that kind of language, and it will require a lot of complex writing.
And that's Mark Zandi, who joins us along with Philip Swagel. We are talking about the economic challenges facing the country, certainly facing President-elect Donald Trump. Let me read an email from Pamela. I'll put this to you, Philip. She says, I want Trump and other wealthy business owners to start paying their fair share of taxes. This would help the national debt. And I guess the question is, do we pay too much? How would we reform our tax system? Should the rich pay more? What do you say?
These are all, the questions that the election's about. So I would encourage the listener to go to the CBO website and look at the statistics on the share of taxes paid by different parts of the income distribution, right? So, what's fair and not fair is in the eyes of the beholder, and people have different opinions,
right.
But we have a very progressive tax system, right? Should the tax system be more progressive or less progressive? Well, that's the debate on which we have elections. It's very progressive now, right? So the sort of rhetoric of the rich don't pay is very difficult to square with the numbers. Again, keeping that separate from should they pay more or less. Let me just say one more thing.
Sure.
In my mind, tax reform has the possibility of increasing our growth rate. Right. I don't think we have to accept 2 or 2.1 or 2.2% GDP growth. We can do better. And the way to do better is to improve the incentives for saving and for investing. And that's exactly what the House tax reform plan will do, right? The missing piece of our recovery has been investment, business investment, and the House tax plan is aimed exactly at that. So I'm very hopeful that it has the possibility to increase our growth. It's one piece of the puzzle, but that's the way I would start, is increase growth and then work on distribution in other ways, right? Improve our education system, improve incentives for people who aren't now working for them to work.
What does tax reform look like to you, Mark Zandi?
I actually think tax reform is a good idea. I mean, I think if we can lower the marginal rate for businesses and pay for it by reducing the loopholes and preferences in the tax code, when pay for it, I mean it's not deficit finance. We're going to lower those marginal rates, but we're going to get rid of those preferences. That's a win. That's going to make our businesses more competitive globally, and it is going to raise growth. It's not going to take us from 2 to 3. It will take us from 2 to 2.25% per annum, something like that. One other point about our tax burden, if you look at total federal tax revenue today, it's 19% of GDP. That's precisely the average amount percentage over the last 35, 40 years. So we're back to where we are historically. So if we cut taxes and lower that, then we're going to be below average relative to the last 35, 40 years. Here's another another factoid that's relevant. Government spending, federal government spending, is now 22.5% to 23% of GDP. That is equal to the average of that ratio over the past 34 years. So government spending and revenues have come back to where they have been on average for many, many decades. And, you know, we change that, then we're doing something that's different than what we've done historically.
Philip Swagel, and to you, Mark Zandi, let me also ask you something that Donald Trump said as he was campaigning, is that he wants to keep or bring companies back to the United States to manufacture, make things like shoes and shirts and TVs and computers. And companies that don't could pay some kind of a tariff or tax or fee or something at the border. Is that good economic policy, Philip Swagel? And I gave a very lay person's description of that. But
no, I understand that. No. It's an incredibly complex area.
It is.
So your description was spot on.
Oh, good. Thank you.
It's really a challenging policy area. And I'm going to distinguish between the kind of company at a time policy, where, you know, Mr. Trump has been calling out, you know, this company or that company, and, policies that affect your entire economy. One of the positive features of the House tax plan is the so-called border adjustment. And one of the implications of that so-called border adjustment is that it removes many, if not most, of the incentives for companies to invert, right, to shift the location of their headquarters overseas, and to shift profits, because the tax will apply on the basis of where things are sold, on the basis of where the customers are, not on the basis of where the production takes place. Right. So right now we have the system that, you know, if you produce in Ireland and sell into the U.S., there's one tax regime. If you're in the U.S., there's another. And we kind of play whack-a-mole to try to get companies not to move to Ireland or move somewhere else. The House tax plan will take care of that, right? It'll level the playing field. We're still going to have a competitive economy and a trained workforce and, you know, all the things we want in our society. But having a tax policy that doesn't actually work against our own domestic economy, that's a really good way to start.
Do you think, Mark Zandi, people will end up then paying more for those shoes and shirts and TVs and computers?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's a lot of debate in the economics community about this, because in theory, if you impose this border adjustment tax, the value of the dollar will rise to offset that effect on prices that consumers pay when they go into the stores. But in practice, that won't be the case. So it will go up. This is one of those ideas that I think nice in theory, but, you know, in practice, very difficult to get to. The transition from getting from here to there will be very painful. And in fact, I think so painful that politically I have a hard time getting my mind around the fact that this is going to get through Congress, because the retailers, you know, the guys that are going to suffer from this are going to really be upset and screaming about this. I'd be very surprised. I will say, though, and Phil mentioned this, and I think this is very important to reemphasize, is that President-elect Trump's policies of using Twitter to browbeat companies is not a strategy for bringing jobs into the country. Effectively, what you're doing is you're raising the cost of doing business in this country. If you're a CEO of a company, you're nervous by this, and it's going to affect your willingness to expand here.
And I do want to pick up on that. That's Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Philip Swagel joining us by phone, professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. We are talking about tax policy under President Obama and President-elect Donald Trump. 1-888-477-9499, the phone number to call to join our conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with two economists about how Trump's policies might affect our economy and your pocketbook. And again, Mark Zandi, Philip Swagel, our guests. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Bunch of comments here, which I will get to. Radiotimes at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Philip Swagel, what do you think about President-elect Donald Trump's use of Twitter, either calling out companies or criticizing very specific companies? Mark and I were talking about a tweet he sent out yesterday about L.L. Bean, telling people to go buy from L.L. Bean because apparently the woman who runs it, or the granddaughter of the founder, was a Trump supporter. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, that's not the way that policy's been done in the past. It's not the way we teach it to our students at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, where I teach. I'll put it that way. You know, politically, I get it that Mr. Trump is looking to create policy space. I mean, he's looking to, in some sense, give himself leverage, and maybe he sees this as a way of doing that, right? That, you know, if he can score, you know, things that he would call wins on the Carrier Corporation, on Ford Motor Company, and others, then that gives him the leverage to do other things, whether it's tax reform or his immigration plan or, you know, whatever else he has in mind. That could be one interpretation for what he's doing. You know, on the other hand, it is just it's not the way I'd want broad policy done for the country.
Do you want to add to that, Mark?
I think Phil said it quite well. Okay. I mean, this isn't the way you conduct policy for it's not a winning long-term strategy for getting more jobs in the country. You're making life very uncomfortable for lots of people for no reason.
Let me get Ed from looks like Lansdale to join our conversation.
And
yeah, Ed,
hi,
go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Whether either of the interviewees have a reaction to what I saw Sunday's New York Times destination-based cash flow tax with border adjustments?
That's a question, Ed. And I'm looking at
This is what we were talking about.
Right.
So that's a longer way of saying the border adjustment tax. So it's simply I'm going to tax imports and I'm not going to tax exports. That's basically what it is. And in my view, there are some benefits to that, but the costs of actually implementing it are very difficult to do, and I don't think will get done because of the politics of this. I mean, retailers are going to be very upset. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I do think it will mean a increase in prices for things that we buy at the store, apparel, furniture, food, things that are imported. And as a result, I would be surprised if that got through Congress.
Let me put another issue on the table. And Mark Zandi said to me during the break, don't forget immigration. And it's on my list of things to talk about. So important when talking about the U.S. economy.
I should have probably said, don't forget about the Eagles or something.
I've already forgotten about them, believe
me.
Oh,
yeah, we all have. Sorry.
Whole other sorry subject. But do you, Philip Swagel, and again, going back to the campaign trail, and we'll see what happens once Donald Trump gets sworn in as president. But we talked about tax reform. Do we need some kind of immigration reform? Not that we haven't tried to do this in the past, including under President Bush, whom you worked for.
Exactly. And of course, one of the sad ironies is that one of the people who sabotaged President Bush's effort was then-Senator Obama, right? I mean, he signed on to a poison pill from then-Senator Dorgan. So there is a sort of, cosmic justice, unfortunately, in the difficulties here. Justice is probably the wrong word. Immigration reform it would be an important way to strengthen growth in our society, and I would say increase the justice and fairness of our society. For the economy, I would look at high-skilled immigration, right? People who get an engineering degree from Drexel, right, a great school, a great degree from a foreign country, we shouldn't kick them out. We should welcome them and have them contribute to our society. And that's the kind of immigration reform that would strengthen our economy. At the same time, that is tightly connected politically to low-skilled immigration or family-based immigration policy. There has to be a solution, right? President Obama had two executive orders, and it's pretty easy politically to see a distinction between those two, right? The children who arrived,
right.
Versus doing things beyond that for the parents and others who obviously understood the actions they were taking. Hopefully, we can make progress on that as a society.
Do you think, Mark, that the numbers of unskilled, undocumented immigrants depress wages for native-born workers?
There's some evidence of that, yeah. I don't think that's the case now, and I don't think it will be the case going forward, because I think our biggest problem going forward will be a lack of labor.
We don't have enough workers.
Not enough workers, skilled and unskilled. And that goes just to demographics. The boomer generation is retiring. The growth in the labor force is slowing. And even if immigration stays where it is, it's going to come to a standstill. So our business's biggest problems a year from now, 2 years from now, invite me back and we could talk about it, because that's going to be their problem. So we need more immigrants, of all kinds of immigrants. And in the only way we're going to go from 2% growth to 3% growth in a consistent manner is by reforming immigration law and allowing more immigrants into the country. And by the way, there's no way President Trump is going to be able to create a lot of jobs unless he allows more immigrants in the country. In fact, if he requires the 11 million undocumented immigrants to leave or some portion to leave and makes it more difficult for illegal immigrants to come into the country, employment growth is going to be even weaker, because we are at full employment. That means everyone who wants a job is working. So the growth in jobs is going to equal, by definition, the growth in the population in the labor force. So if you have fewer people, you're going to have less labor force, you're going to have less employment. So the only way to get more jobs is more immigration.
Do you see it that way, Philip Swagel? And how does the wall figure into what Mark Zandi just said?
Yeah. I agree for the most part with Mark. I would just add two other pieces to the puzzle, and I suspect he would agree with this as well. One is participation, right? So the millions of people now who are not participating. Some of that is just age, right? We can't expect you know, sort of someone a certain age to participate. But there are other factors as well, and part of it is the opioid epidemic. So participation is one, and then skills is the other, right? Reforming our education system and doing better on training for adults, retraining for adults. The wall, you know, it's hard to know exactly. There's clearly societal dissatisfaction with what's going on with immigration, the sense that we don't control our border. On the other hand, when millions of people want to come to the United States, it's hard not to see that as an incredibly positive vote in our society, right? I would be much more worried if people were fleeing, right? So so somehow we have to do something that as a society and politically works, that we feel like we control our borders, but fundamentally we should be welcoming people to add to our society.
Phil, did you just say, though, that you think the opioid epidemic, the crisis, is affecting our economy?
It is, and there's some really interesting research on this about essentially prime age men who are not participating, and the research suggests that a big part of that is that people, men especially, are on pain medication, and that's why they're not participating. Mm-hmm. So getting a handle on that seems like an important piece of the puzzle also.
So incarceration as well.
I mean, incarceration as well.
That's a big piece of the puzzle, and even the increase in the number of people in the military has affected things too, so all of the above.
Let me read another comment. Apparently, Trump didn't pay taxes for 20 years because of loopholes in the tax code that billionaires can use to pay their taxes, or I guess not pay their taxes. Will this continue under his new tax plan? And it's interesting, we talked about tax reform with a president who says he's not going to release his taxes because they're under audit. I'm looking at you, Mark Zandi.
Well, I don't know. You know, we don't have a lot of detail. We have no detail really yet on exactly how reform on the personal side of the tax code is going to look. So I'm not sure. Phil, do you know if his particular – to be frank, we really don't know what loophole he actually used, right? We have some sense of it. I mean, he had a big real estate deal, huge losses, and then he can use those losses against his future revenues and not pay taxes for many years. That's a hypothesis. We don't know for sure. But I don't know if that's going to be eliminated in the reforms. Do you know by any chance, Phil?
Phil?
You know, I don't know. Right, the focus of tax reform so far has been on the business side because that's where there's the most bipartisan consensus that the U.S. tax code needs change. On the personal side, it's harder harder to say.
But do you think, Phil, that we should see his taxes?
You know, that's a political question.
It is a political question.
Yeah, the American people have said, I'm an economist, so ask me anything economic, I'm answering. You know, his answer is that the American people spoke, and they voted for him, the election's over, and so on. I mean, you know, that's a political question.
Do you want to take a political question, Mark Zandi?
Hey, you know, I think it's reasonable to ask to see the fellow's tax return. Come on. You know, this guy's going to be running the nation, and it'd be nice to see where he stands on a lot of things. So, yeah, of course, we should see his tax returns.
Let me get Wade from Northeast Philly to join our conversation. Hi, Wade. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
With the call for advancements and increasing manufacturing in this country, I just wondered if people are looking at the external costs associated with that in terms of just potentially increased considerations for pollution, and also the import, presumably, of raw materials for said manufacturing. And one other comment, if he's going to do, president-elect is going to do an infrastructure program, I think he should just put a program that there's going to replace all the lead pipes in the country that's carrying our water supply.
I hear you. Wade, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And to both of you, to Phil, we haven't really talked much about things like manufacturing. And certainly Donald Trump talked about bringing back manufacturing, the coal industry as well. How do you see it, Phil?
You know, manufacturing would be boosted in part by the tax plan, right? It removes some of the incentives to move production overseas. On the other hand, right, what we want is a stronger economy and stronger growth. You know, we want the market to figure out which sectors of the economy grow and which don't. I thought the caller made some really good points One is the effects on pollution, the impact on raw materials. And those are going to be challenges. The part on raw materials, to me, was really interesting because, right, we know when our economy is strong, we bring in lots of things from overseas, right? If we have a strong economy, that's when we have more imports and a wider trade deficit. So I would say keep our eye on the ball, as the caller, I think, hinted at, by looking at the strong economy and saying that's the goal. And not any one particular part of the economy, so long as the growth is broadly shared. I'm sorry, I had one, and then one last thought, which I thought the last thing the caller said was really interesting on the lead pipes, which we've all seen in Michigan, the tragic effects there. That seems like a really good idea. That you know, people focus on infrastructure, roads and bridges and airports, but absolutely some of the underpinnings of our cities. That is a great idea.
Appreciate the call. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, Lee. I was just going to say that is a great idea. I think it is, though. The only way we're going to be able to do that is if the federal government spends directly on replacing those lead pipes. And much of what Mr. Trump has talked about in the context of increasing infrastructure is so-called public-private partnerships. And those only work if you can get a toll, you know, get paid for, because you have to pay off your private investors. So I think if we're going to have increased infrastructure spending, and I think we should, and if we're going to devote it to things like lead pipe replacement, which I think we should, then that's going to require federal outlays, you know, direct checks cut from the federal government. And we're going to have to be more creative than what Mr. Trump has been talking about, at least so far.
Let me squeeze in a tweet here from Mitchell. He says, let's assume Donald Trump's promise is realized and manufacturing jobs return. Without unions and government regulations, the U.S. may look more like China than Germany. Phil, what do you say to that?
I mean, it's probably an extreme way of putting it, without regulations and so forth. And I kind of made that point earlier.
Right.
The question is getting the balance right. I think a reasonable argument can be made that we've gone too far in one direction. And so rebalancing that, how far the Trump administration goes, that is a legitimate question, and we have to wait and see. Ending up like China, boy, I look at the pictures of pollution there and you know, the lack of freedoms. It is I don't think Americans will want to end up like China.
Mark, let me give you the last crack at looking at the people that Donald Trump wants in his administration, whether Treasury Secretary, Labor Secretary, trade, all of that. What's your takeaway? What's your feel about the people that he wants surrounding him?
You know, I think some are good, very competent. Steve Mnuchin is the fellow who's going to run Treasury Secretary, if you get through the confirmation process. You know, very smart guy. He knows markets. He knows global financial markets. I think he'll be very good. You know, the folks he's bringing in on trade make me nervous. You know,
fine.
Peter Navarro, UC Irvine professor, I've had conversations with him. And he's very anti-trade, anti-globalization. He wants to rip up NAFTA. I mean, I don't think TPP – I think TPP is a good idea. We should do it. You know, he's got a very different view. So it depends, you know. But I guess that's the same in any administration. Mm-hmm. You know, some folks you think are going to do a great job and some not. But that's certainly the case in the Trump administration as well.
I guess, Phil, I'm giving you the last word. Any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
No, I agree with Mark. I mean, Mr. Mnuchin seems like a strong, you know, strong choice. Gary Cohn at the National Economic Council as well. So that is that's really good. Wilbur Ross at Commerce also is a strong voice on the economy. So it's a good start.
Philip Swiggle, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. Professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, worked in the second Bush administration in the Treasury Department. Mark Zandi, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Chief Economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. There was a lot of interest and a lot of questions that sitting on my screen here. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.